Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here with episode 390 and part one of our conversation with Minneapolis-based freelance percussionist, educator, and director of marketing and percussionist for the 10th Wave Chamber Music Collective, Ari Isamora. We'll get back to her shortly. But first up, an end and a beginning. For Marching Mizzou, we closed out our season with Band 138 this past weekend, with our drum major finals on Saturday, and our annual band banquet on Sunday. As is usually the case with the banquet, the most exciting part of it is that the students show up in something like formal wear and look really nice. I know this was the case back for me in the day, when some students would appear unrecognizable because they were doing things like not wearing a hat and sunglasses, that would be me, or dressing in nice clothes for once. Which is also me. And you think to yourself, wow, I don't recognize these people at all when they're not sweating and tired and holding their instrument on the band field. Stuff like that. In any case, we've now begun the process for next year's band, as Marching Mizzou's new leadership team will meet throughout the spring and summer to prepare for the fall season. Oh yeah, and there's classes and teaching and such as it is, a lot of grading and a ton of concerts. Must be April. Speaking of which, if you're in the Midwest, Missouri's annual Day of Percussion is being held this Saturday, April 13th, at Battle High School in Columbia. It's been hosted there pretty regularly for years, and it's a great space for performances and clinics for many, many students. Come on out if you're able to see. And with that, let's get to our conversation with Ari Isamora. I first became aware of Ari through my conversation with previous podcast guest Matt McClung, who teaches at St. Olaf College in Minneapolis, where Ari was a professor there for a number of years. It seemed like a great time to reach out to Ari, and here we are. Ari's been involved in the percussion scene for a while now. She grew up and still has family in the Minneapolis area and has been freelancing locally for many years. In addition to her teaching, which includes percussion and piano, she is the director of marketing and percussionist for 10th Wave Music, a Pierrot-style chamber collective, locally based, and regularly performing works by living composers with a focus on underrepresented members. She also regularly plays with many ensembles in the area. There's so much to get to in Ari's career that we ended up going long, so we'll be splitting this up into two parts. This week, in part one, we'll get to Ari's current life and work in Minneapolis, her higher education and studio teaching, managing her career as a new mom, growing up in Minneapolis, and her time at St. Olaf as an undergrad. Next week, in part two, we'll get to the rest. So let's get to it! We recorded this interview over Zoom on February 29th, 2024, and it begins right now. Give me a summation of your percussion responsibilities and activities as they are right now.
I am a performer and educator. I am a solo marimba player and percussionist. I freelance regionally. So I recently played in orchestras. So, you know, timpani and, you know, the concert percussion, the whole jam, around, the Twin Cities in Minnesota. And then I taught at St. Olaf College, which is an undergrad in, Minnesota. I did that as adjunct faculty for, 4 years. And then I also, have my own private studio. I teach in my house. In my living room, I have a timpani, one timpani that didn't fit through the basement door, and marimba and piano. So I teach a lot of piano and percussion. And I was teaching at a K-8 school, teaching percussion class to 4th grade, 5th grade, and 6th grade. And I started that during the pandemic, and then I kept going until this past spring because in the summer I had a baby, and so that changed everything. And so at this point for percussion, I am on leave from the school and I no longer teach at St. Olaf, but I still teach private lessons. And then I do a full calendar of performing around town. So that is recording projects, my own recitals, my own nonprofit, which I will get to, and concert percussion. So the nonprofit I'm playing percussion in is a group that my friends and I have founded called 10th Wave Chamber Music Collective. And that is circa 2018, end of 2017. We wanted to start a new music group. And so it's a piero ensemble, but it's a collective. So every piece is programmed and then we find the instruments, basically. So it's not a set instrumentation at all. And there's plenty of marimba and percussion playing in these pieces. So yeah, so we curate and present all of our concerts like 4 times a year. And that's also around Minnesota as well. So that that performing is also connected to, I'm directing the marketing as well. And then I was writing grants for it before. Now we've delegated it, but that's a whole function. And then another thing is I am the chapter president for Minnesota Percussive Arts Society. So we are trying to get some more events going around the state and meeting more people. Because Minnesota has a lot of hubs, I guess. There's the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul area. And then there's the Northwest Fargo, Moorhead area. And then there's also the Eastern side, Northeast, like Duluth, Superior, and then the Southeast, Rochester, Winona, and then Southwest is like Marshall. And so, yeah, so there are a lot of cities. It's kind of widespread. So for the state, I'm trying to think of more ways to get the percussionists talking and get them connected. So, and drummers too. So that's all very fun.
And that's it. Like, we've covered everything, or is that just Monday and Tuesday? That's what you're doing the rest of the week.
Yeah, that's kind of in a nutshell, the general term. You know how freelancing is. It's never all the same ever.
Right.
So,
including whenever they decide to pay you for all that stuff.
Oh yeah. I don't, it's been a while since I've accepted a gig that is unpaid. So yeah. It's okay.
Fair enough. Let's start with what brought you to Minneapolis in the first place.
I was born and raised in St. Paul, and I grew up in the St. Paul suburb called Roseville, and I went to public school and everything like that. But I settled down here because my family is here, and I went to school at St. Olaf, where I was teaching recently, right? And then I went to Boston Conservatory for my master's, and then I was thinking maybe I would plant some roots in Boston. And then I realized that my family is all still in Minnesota, and also the standard of living. It's much easier to live in Minnesota. There's also plenty of arts grants and funding in Minnesota as well. So I went back home, and since then it's been great. Yep, just a mid-sized town. It's a smaller community. So then everybody knows everybody, which is great.
When you come back from Boston, what's the first thing you're doing professionally when you come back?
So that was 2016. And then that's when I was starting to get back on my feet for, you know, gigs. And because networking takes several years for you to get the right kind of gigs. I had been working since 2011. So since after graduating from undergrad, I actually had a wrist injury and I did not play for a while. And during that time, I was at home in Minnesota, and I started working at the Minnesota Orchestra Music Library. And that's where I started a training for library work in orchestras. So In 2016, when I got back, I was just finding more ways to connect with people. So I became the librarian for a community orchestra here. I also still worked back at the Minnesota Orchestra. And then I went to the National Repertory Orchestra as a librarian for 3 years. And that was, and so then I was able to sub for the orchestra as percussionist at that time as well. So at that point in 2016, I was looking for library work as well as performing. 10th Wave was getting started. And I just waited and talked to freelance percussionists in the area for small projects here and there. Made sure I kept playing. So there are plenty of groups around. So there's La Crosse Symphony, there's Mankato Symphony. They're all just, they're regional orchestras, but they're still playing pretty hefty works. So, and then I started to get a lot of choir gigs as well. So they love marimba. I don't know. Choirs love marimba, and Minnesota is known as the 10,000 lake, the land of 10,000 lakes, but it's also the 10,000 choirs. Because there's so many Lutherans and so many choirs. I don't know what it is. The National Lutheran Choir is based in Minnesota.
I might be wrong. I think it's a massive handbell choir place too.
Yes. Yes, it is. That is also big. And they are very serious about their handbells. Not mess with their handbells. Organized, beautiful sounds. So marimba, and then also I was getting called a lot for Christmas choir concerts and their marimba needs as well. And then some of them would be churches that wanted a marimba for their service. And then they would, and then there are some neat pieces too. Some people asked me to play marimba and vibraphone for a whole cantata that was for choir and guitar, harp, and marimba vibes, which was really beautiful. So there are random pieces like that out there that make it fun. I was also going to mention that I was in the Heartland Marimba Ensemble. Marimba is led by Matthew Coley, and he lives in Waterloo, Iowa. But I mean, now he is the director at Kutztown at the Rap Center. And so while he was in Iowa, and right before the pandemic, they asked me to perform as part one of their showcase artists in Minnesota. And then pandemic hit. Matthew was in Waterloo, which is 3 hours away from here. And so I would drive down with another marimba player, and we would, we just carpool, go down and perform a whole virtual concert during the pandemic. So, we did a lot of recording projects like that. And then slowly we would perform more around town. We went to Chicago, et cetera. And then we also performed at PASIC in 2022. So that was super fun. But yeah, that was a tour. I drove my van. And so that was 18-hour drive in one day. And did it with a friend, who was also in the group. But yeah, that was pretty brutal. Oh my gosh, was it 18? I'll Google that. But if it was pretty brutal. We were just like, it was 2 a.m. Let's just go. Two more hours. Yeah. Holy smokes. So that was a whole adventure. For that tour too, my library skills really kicked in, because we were all running around on 12 instruments or like 20. It was like 20, and everybody kept switching during the piece, right? Or like during the concert, people are assigned different pieces, and how do you organize all the music, all the tablets, everything, right? So then I got out my orchestra library hat, and I assigned a folder to each instrument so that instead of and an iPad to each instrument based on, you know, if a player's on one instrument for the majority of the concert, then they can do that. And then whoever switches to that spot, we'll just put it in that iPad so that the music is all in one spot. So no one is moving music around during the show. So that kind of thing. Who knew that that skill would come in handy for a marimba ensemble?
So, yeah.
Yeah. And otherwise, yeah, so percussion for, oh yeah, the choirs, new music too. New music for choirs that would ask for marimba. There was a Peter Klatzow piece, Something About the Moon. We'll have to look that up. But it's a choir and marimba piece. And it's a pretty, very beautiful piece. And that, and then more commissions for marimba and choir. And another group called Champagne Confetti started up. So that's I don't even know how to classify it. It's two singers, one's on, two lead singers. One is on keys as well. And three singers, three backup singers as well. And then string bass, drums, marimba, vibraphone, cello, violin, and another violin, but they're lower, so they have a five-string violin. A five-string violin, yeah. So it's like a violin-viola hybrid.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm sure viola players are thrilled by this.
Right. Just an outsource. No. Yeah. It's like, oh, wait, but that's my job.
Right.
That's the one thing I can do that's different. Yeah. Anyway. No. Viola players are wonderful, and we need them for orchestras to survive. Anyway, yes. And then I started touring with them because they would go on tour around Minnesota. I was their vibraphone player, and we recently released the first self-titled album that was last year, and they still keep. So it's a band that kind of keeps performing maybe once or twice a year. But it's such a big group, and we all have, you know, different gigs going on because everybody's kind of a specialist in their own field. And then we're all just kind of coming together as friends to do this band. And it's an incredible time every time. So that's a fun project that it's everybody. It's at the basically it's the fun one, right? Yeah, it's not it's not hard. It's just fun. And, you know, every musician, it's nice to have that kind of outlet for your profession. So other than that, lots of teaching. So there's a youth orchestra community here as well. So I would coach sectionals as a percussionist. So I think I'm missing things, but maybe I'll think of them later.
Okay. So we've gotten to Wednesday now. Now we're just
getting
a long weekend of Aries long weekend situation.
Yeah. So. Sorry, it's just I can't not do more than I can't not do less than three things in one day. I just feel like I'm not moving enough I keep going. But it gets a little tricky sometimes. And burn out and then I come back. So make sure you eat your favorite foods and exercise and you're set.
Maybe not your favorite foods all the time, actually.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Nice. Just a follow-up then, how do you organize? Do you use a planner? What's your go-to app or calendar situation to make everything work?
Google Calendar tells me what to do every day. Sometimes it's hard because I would write rehearsal
and not know which one it was.
You know, like where am I supposed to be at 4:15? Oh no. Rehearsal for what? Where? What am I playing? So I make sure, you know, some names are on there. And so the phone chimes 10 minutes before an event happens, and that's why I don't like overpopulating my calendar. Cause if I say, oh, I need to get organized and micromanage everything else that doesn't have to do with rehearsal or lessons or you know, some event that people are relying on me to be there and it needs to happen right now, that other. If so then I say, if I put on the calendar meal prep or something, mm-hmm. right? And I just get angry at my calendar, like, how dare you scare me? Like, am I supposed to be somewhere in 10 minutes?
What am I supposed to make?
What? Yeah, I'm supposed to just make dinner. I could have. Okay, yeah. So, you know, the past me was well-intended, but it always freaks me out when I second-guess myself. But sometimes it is nice because I get home and I get settled down and I'm just ready to hang out and watch watch a movie or play some Zelda on Switch or something. And then the chime goes and it says I have a lesson in 10 minutes. Oh, well, I am so glad I am almost ready. Yes. So I definitely use Google. And then I have multiple calendars on that. So my nonprofit meetings are all on there, and also make sure that my husband sees it so that if he sees that he needs to be home because I will be gone, then we make sure that we make sure the child is taken care of.
Of course.
Yeah. So yeah, that, and if I need to make meetings happen, then I could use Doodle or Lettuce Meet. Or have you used Lettuce Meet?
No, I've used
like When to Meet.
It's like what?
It's like When to Meet. It's like the app where you click and drag when you're available during those days.
No, I have not done that.
I think it's more fun than Doodle, but but I can use both. But Lettuce Meet, like literally lettuce, like the vegetable.
Meat. Oh, of course.
Yeah. And that one is similar to it, but somehow it makes it a little easier. Yeah. So lots of apps and lots of Google, Google Drive, Google Calendar to make sure everything is in line.
Tell me, I know that you're not teaching there or either at all or anymore, but what was your responsibilities when you were teaching at St. Olaf?
Oh, yeah, I was adjunct private instructor. So what was happening was that the instructor, Dave Hagedorn, that was there as the percussion guy there. And there's also a drum set teacher, Phil A., but he's only drum set. And Dave had too many students, so then they hired me to take a small portion of his studio. So then I would just be there once a week, and it's a 50-minute drive. And doing that on the ice, icy roads in the winter is not fun. So it's much easier if you live in that town. But anyway, so I was there once a week to teach up to 5 students or so, and then virtually during the pandemic as well. And then the last year I was there, I was the director of the improvisation ensemble, which is not like a class; it's a literal ensemble. So then so the first semester, it was actually started by JC Sanford, who is a jazz trombonist, and he was a jazz band director there for a while, and he started this improv group. And then, and he would use a lot of conduction, which is, it is like conducting, but for improvising. So then it's more like hand signals and, you know, numbers and little gestures like sign language to certain sections and groups and individuals to tell them what needs to happen right now with your improvising. So it comes out of free jazz in a way. So it's a lot more. There's a lot of depth into it. Yeah. So I was studying that and trying to do conduction with an improvistra, basically, and that was really great. I love seeing college students improvising. That's not something you really see. I think college students are just so in their noses in their books, like in their music, and they're so note to note. And to see them spend 10 minutes with by themselves or with other people to improvise and to kind of just make sound and noise and see where it goes. I got a lot of influence of that from my masters, where you can just take your time to listen and hear each other and make a story or converse or dance or, you know, like, you know, whatever happens in that moment. But putting students in those moments was really cool to see that. And there's some really beautiful things that come out of it. So sound for sound's sake, in a way. And so that was a full semester of that. But otherwise, yeah, sometimes I would sub for directing the percussion ensemble, and et cetera. At that point, the whole time I was still only there for once a week. I would teach and then I would do the ensemble.
So it was not feasible now that you are mom
for you
to make that trip, I would assume.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult topic of, you know, how far, like once things, you know, topics like that come up of how far can I go with saying yes to things when you're responsible for a family, especially for me as a mother. There's a full there's a whole bag of things to consider and manage when you think about the best interest of the child. So as a freelance musician, I often do wonder how it's different for a freelance percussionist that is a father a freelance percussionist that's a mother. And most of it's the same. If there's a sense of needing to be fulfilled by your career, at the same time being there for your child, enough, right? But how do you balance that? And the child doesn't know what they want until, you know, some are very particular, but most of the time you want to do your best to make sure they're learning, they're growing. It's been quite a journey. He's 6 months now, so I'm just starting to get back into all of it, and now I can't make decisions the same way,
right?
Yeah, which is fun at the same time, you know.
Yeah, for a good reason.
And he was a very easy baby. He is a very easy baby, knock on wood. You know, getting back into things is almost too easy that I need to figure out how to balance it before I say yes to too many things. And then he starts to walk. He starts to need more of my attention, you know. But right now he doesn't move around yet. So then I can practice while he's there, you know, with his little toys. And he doesn't mind. He actually falls asleep when I'm practicing drum set and timpani.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. I have a theater production coming up where I'll be playing drum set. So that'll be fun. I'll just have to rely on childcare during the evenings, because it's a few weekends. It's at least 3 weekends of shows. So it's a very flip flop from a 9-to-5 schedule for sure. So
the other aspect is whether your partner has there, if they're like a full time, you know, not more 9-to-5 or that kind of work, is that's another factor of, you know, who is either primary breadwinner or whose work requires them to be somewhere else for a long period of time or to be home, you know, that kind of, like, all those factors are also involved in all these decisions you're having to make.
Absolutely. And I'm grateful that my husband is working from home. So he doesn't have a commute, which means he is a little bit, well, his commute is 20 feet.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not like I have to bother him all the time, but it's helpful to have him just in case something happens. But yeah, he is a lot more available to help out, and it is a shared thing, parenthood. So then it's kind of easier to delegate who's in charge right now, or who's like the primary point person, caretaker right now. And it's like by the hour, it's different.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. So, yeah, with his job, it's much easier for me to make decisions based on what is fulfilling versus what is lucrative. And it's great when they're the same. When they're the same gig, it's great. But constantly, I do have to think about if that gig is worth taking or not. My friend had a good way of figuring that out. She says it's the three M's. It's music, money, and mates. So if the music's good, so out of the three things, if you have two of them, then you're good. Then it's worth taking, saying yes to. And so if the music is good, if the money is good, or if the mates, so the friends or the people in it are good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thankfully, the nonprofit, so 10th Wave, is all three, which is helpful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's the ideal trifecta, right? It's sustainable to do. And it's a very different mindset from being a student and thinking, oh, well, I have to do this right now because this is my chance to learn something so challenging, and I'm going to pour my sweat, blood, and tears into it and take all this time to learn it, etc. But that's not really the case once you leave school. And then if you're really passionate about learning something, then you have to really budget your time to do it. And it's totally doable. School's definitely a different mindset.
It's interesting when you say, when you put the three M's together, because there are definitely times where the mates part, you don't realize how much that matters.
Yeah.
Because I just think of some things I do, I'm like, okay, I'm doing that because I really like the people. And that can carry a lot to
make
decisions.
And, you know, if it doesn't have to do with your career, it doesn't have to have money or music.
Sure.
You just hanging out with your friends, right?
Yeah. Trivia nights, whatever,
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Regarding 10th Wave, is it a nonprofit?
Yep. It's a 501c3.
So it has a board.
We have a board. And we want to keep building it so that it's sustainable. And that's all very hard because none of us that started it are trained in music business. Zero. And I think you probably get a lot of guests that keep saying that music performer, performance majors definitely need the business class.
Oh yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's just everywhere. Everybody's just so angry that didn't happen. Like the both schools that I went to had like half of that training kind of embedded. They taught me how to write well. They taught me how to be practical with making a website, etc. And with when I was at Boston Conservatory, it wasn't swallowed up, bought by Berkeley yet.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm sorry. They did not merge yet. So. swallowed it.
Like a giant fish.
Exactly. Berkeley had some classes that I could take. Before the merger happened, BOCO students could take Berkeley classes. Berkeley students could take BOCO classes. So I took advantage of that because my professor, Nancy Zaltzman, she would teach at both. She was teaching marimba class and at Berklee, as well as at BoCo. So then all the marimbas and stuff were in the Berklee building. And I also was able to take legal aspects of the music business class. And that was really great too. So, you know, negotiating, talking about copyright, royalties, that stuff. So that was really great to take. But yes, all of that came, all of that knowledge was starting, you know, some of it was useful to Test Wave, starting a nonprofit, arts nonprofit, writing grants and getting funding on a project-based manner. So then you would curate the program so that it, so that we could promise the grant funding organizers what we're going to do. And we're going to talk about, you know, like, or we're going to focus on pieces that, that refer to incarceration, or like imprisonment of some kind, or, yeah. So like really cool topics that are, I mean, those aren't cool, but, really important, life topics that are really relevant to everybody, in community. And so we would find repertoire that, that would talk around, that would play around those topics. And then a lot of things happened during the pandemic. Minneapolis, George Floyd happened, Black Lives Matter, like a lot of unrest happened, and it was pretty scary. But during that time, a lot of arts organizations started to stand up for Black Lives Matter and movement, a lot of underrepresentation, like focus, and trying to lift up people. Not just use our own voices to lift them up, but also to sponsor in a way to bring those people in to show what they want to say. So yeah, that also kind of changed the philosophy of what 10th Wave wants to do as well. Instead of just playing new music, we only want to play music of living composers, that are, living, local and or underrepresented. So then we're lifting up the Twin Cities community and also bringing up important repertoire that's relevant to this day. So that's all very relevant to grant funding as well, because they're very community-based. And also 10th Wave is the three leaders are Asian American females, and we have a lot of diversity in our ensemble, and and our audience is kind of reflecting that as well. So yeah, it's a niche for sure. Like, who wants to go and listen to new chamber music, you know? Well, we have to show that it is really awesome, but for people to even give it a chance, right? We gotta get more people into the concert, like through the doors. And that's one of those things that all classical groups are struggling with now too. Before the pandemic, even people going to in-person classical concerts has been going down. So then what do you do to change that? You know, and there's a lot of marketing strategies and things that, again, we never learned in school, but here we are trying to learn it on the job, kind of like any other really specialized job where you can't learn it in the classroom. Yeah. So grant writing and fundraising and marketing. Yeah. And just networking too. And Minneapolis, St. Paul, there's a lot of small little networks. So it's good to dip your toe in all of them and then try to figure out what new project can come up next.
How are you getting connected to the local composers?
Mm. So they show up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I would have concerts. People would show up to the concert, or they would cold call us and tell us that they, you know, they're interested in working with us. There are other new music initiatives around town that are also connecting. And then there are also grants that are toward composers as well by the American Composers Forum, New Music USA, Chamber Music. Those are more Chamber Music USA. There's more Chamber Music America, right? Those are more national. But the Jerome Fund is, I think there's a lot of Minnesota-based successes for that one. And them and their networks too. But slowly it kind of stems out of people coming to our concerts or people that I would meet at other gigs that are composers, or their work was premiered in that orchestra concert. So then I would talk to them and then we would get connected, right? So MMEA just happened, which is the Minnesota Music Educators Association. And they, so that was the whole conference. And there's so many composer commissions and premieres that high schools are now doing with their bands and orchestras, which is incredible. I feel like when I was in high school, nothing was new. Everything was, I mean, that's sustainable. It's so expensive to commission. Yeah. So then I met some of those composers as well. So that was really great. So yeah, it just kind of takes a little bit more of, hi, I'm blank and I heard your piece. That was awesome. Do you want to be friends? Can we be friends?
Do you like playing Nintendo Switch? Like, let's get this.
Whoa. Yes. No. Yeah. But yeah, random questions that, during the pandemic, 10th Wave had a virtual reception after a virtual concert viewing. And one of the composers did join us for Mario Kart and whooped all of our butts.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
We're going to back up. And I know you've already mentioned that you grew up in the Minneapolis area. Did you have any family members in the arts?
Yes. Yes. That's probably the only reason why we're here. So my father was a cellist in the Minnesota Orchestra for 38 years. He retired in 2017, and now he's on grandpa mode. So he's still practicing like 4 hours a day. It's mad.
Really? Is he?
Yeah. He's like,
for what? Is he playing still?
He's playing a ton. Oh, yeah. Just for fun. And he was in the orchestra for so long. And then he's just living the good life. Like he's always been a chamber musician. So now he gets to pick who he plays with. Mm-hmm. He gets to choose which music to play.
Yeah. Yep. He doesn't have to listen. He doesn't have to listen to a conductor tell him what to do.
It's pretty great.
Yeah.
So he's living it up for sure. So he's doing retirement well, I think.
Nice.
I think I've seen many other retirement transitions. You know, some people sell their instruments after they retire from the orchestra,
yeah,
and then they just watch baseball all day. Like it's cool. But some people cannot live without their instrument, and that's my dad. So, yeah. So his training is Japan and the U.S., and he ended up in Minnesota by audition in the 70s. So yeah. And then he raised a family here, and which was me and my siblings. So all of our immediate, we're the only immediate family here. Everybody else is in Japan or elsewhere around the world. But music was really big in my dad's side. And yeah, so he has two other brothers that are violists. Mm. One passed away, but he was in Germany he was playing viola for an opera company, opera house. Yeah. And then the other violist is, was in the Tokyo String Quartet, which disbanded.
Oh.
In what was that, 2013, I think they were done. But yeah, so, and that uncle, he's still teaching in Japan, and he's teaching string quartet, which I guess is his thing. Yeah. But yeah, he was in that quartet forever, and they were very successful. But if that uncle did not go to New York, or he was just like a one-way ticket to America, and then he got hooked up with, music teachers, so that he didn't have to go back. And then my dad followed soon after. So yeah, my dad played cello his whole life when I was at home after undergrad, because I was going to take a gap year, but I overplayed. So in my undergrad, I was accompanying people on piano, because I was, I played piano competitively through high school. And then in college, I slowly became a percussion major. And then, but I would still play a lot of piano. So I would play my percussion jury, I would play my drum set jury, and I would play 20 other juries of other people's as a pianist, as their collaborative pianist. So then that just completely,
where the cash comes in right there.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, I mean, I really wish it was a little more.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But yeah, it was a little bit of money that just did it. My wrists just could not handle it anymore. And so during that time, we did a lot of projects where I could slowly play the marimba. For a while it was, 2 minutes a day, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 2 minutes, and then it would hurt too much, and then so it'd be zero, and then 2 minutes, 5 minutes, So it was that for 2 years until I could get up to an hour a day. And then I started practicing for grad school, and then I auditioned, and then I got in the next year.
I want to circle back to that, but we'll okay. We'll get to that point. So were you were be a beginning on piano before percussion? Yeah.
Yes. I started when I was 5. I would read music and read letters the same, So it was, they all kind of came at the same time, like music reading and normal reading. So, it was easy for me to adapt. And I was the one sibling, or I was the one child that didn't mind practicing even after, even in middle school, high school. So, and then with band and percussion, I started taking percussion lessons because, my dad thought it was important to have private lessons. I feel like some families, if it's their second instrument, they don't need private lessons for that. They can just figure it out at school. Yeah. But obviously my dad's a musician. He was very excited that I would play the drums. And so I started that. I started percussion private lessons in fifth grade. So by that time, anything percussion was very easy because it's sight readable.
Yes, compared to the piano stuff, yes, very much so.
And then the versatility of both hands, two-hand independence, right?
Yeah.
And then I went to my first lesson and found the marimba there, and I got really excited because it was a piano, but you hit it with two sticks or four, right? I had never seen that before. Mm-hmm. So I've seen xylophones, but it just never occurred to me that this could actually be a thing for me.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's pretty cool when you figure that out too.
Right. Yeah.
There's cool stuff to do on this instrument.
It's a piano.
Sounds nice.
Yeah. It sounds so nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. With piano. Yeah. It was almost too easy to like keep doing percussion, but I still wanted to work hard and do it well. So I practiced my snare drum rolls, practiced my drum set grooves. So it was a side thing. Through high school, I was a lot more invested in piano. And so
when you say, because you said competitively, so what level are we talking, like you were doing concerto competitions, like that level?
Not like nationwide.
Okay.
Some competitions. Yeah. So I would, I did compete for concerto competitions. Yes.
What pieces?
For piano?
Yeah. Which concerto?
It was Prokofiev.
Ooh.
Prokofiev 3.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. There was some Mozart as well at one point.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, mainly, more solo things.
Ah.
So, you know, Chopin for a lot of Haydn. Chopin, I did a lot of, the Ballade number 1.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good one.
Are you a pianist?
Yeah, I've not, my undergrad degree is in piano.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
But I'm not that good though. So I got immediately away from it once I finished the undergrad. But I know all the lit, like, I mean,
right.
You know, I've certainly, as the, I don't know if you've ever seen the joke where it's like there's a joke where they start playing the Rachmaninoff 3, which is like the octaves, like boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's like, this, I could do this. And then it's like, you know, 30 seconds later, they're just like notes all over the place. That'd be me. I'd be like, oh, I could, yeah, that looks so, oh my gosh, what's going on?
Like, whatever you do, don't turn the page. You don't want to see all the ink that's beyond there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And I mean, honestly, sometimes I think beginning piano is a lot more interesting to teach than beginning percussion.
I believe you.
The thing is, that's how I grew up too, right? I have so much piano background that percussion, the beginnings of percussion was very easy to me.
Mm-hmm.
So try to learn music theory and all the stuff on the sheet music, you know, for percussion. If you didn't have any background, it's a lot harder.
Yeah.
So much harder. And I mean, you know, out of privilege and luck and whatever, I was able to have piano. And some kids don't have that opportunity. And then they just have percussion and then they nail it and they're amazing and that's great. So, but for me, when I'm teaching beginners, there's a lot more, there's a lot more stuff we can do with piano that is transferable to percussion and many other instruments too. I think piano is just a good way to start. But yeah, so which is why, like during the pandemic, I had 40 piano students, and that was super fun because I didn't mind. It was just basically kind of repeating what I did when I was growing up, which is I think it comes naturally for most people. If you know how it was, then you have a good grip on it when you're starting it in adulthood. So, but you're on the other side of it,
right?
Yeah, as a teacher. And
yes. I'm sorry. So when you're growing up and before you get to college, are on the percussion side, were you doing, was there a marching component to what you're doing?
No. And my high school did not have marching band.
Okay.
I was focusing on like marimba concerto.
Oh, okay.
You know, or other, you know, big marimba formale pieces. But I mean, I didn't get to like Keiko Abe until the end of my senior year. It's not like I was that crazy good. I was in a small bowl.
You weren't playing Merlin to warm up, I guess, is what you're saying, right?
No. That would be nuts.
Yeah, right.
All of that ink.
Yeah.
I had no idea what percussion was supposed to sound like too, because there weren't as many role models in that sense.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. When I'm in public school, like if I do something and people say it's incredible, it's amazing, how do you hold two mallets in one hand? Mm-hmm. Then as a high schooler and a people pleaser, it's much easier to just sit there and not have to, you don't, I mean, I'm working hard and working hard to do what my teacher asked me to do, but I didn't really look beyond into the world of what's possible.
Sure.
Because I was also doing piano. and
right.
sports and theater. I like, you know, I was doing all of it. So.
Yeah. But you don't have the, on piano, everyone's like, yeah, I've seen, I know what a pianist does. Like, yeah, I get it. Marimba's like, oh.
Right. It's like, oh, wow. Well, you can do everything.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
People are just so impressed by that.
Yeah, they are. You do a one-handed roll, and some people, like, whoa. Their mind is blown. You
know? Like, run out the door. Like, whoa. Yeah. But, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I didn't have marching. So all the rudimental chop, slang, that kind of work was – I was trained more in that later on, but in independent lessons. It was never in a group because St. Olaf doesn't have a marching band either. So yeah, I've always been on the outside of that. And now there's so many people in drumline. There's so many people in drum corps, and that's the lifestyle of like music and the marimba, which in a way, that's not my training. But I sincerely want more students to be exposed to the marimba for sure. And if it's front ensemble, like that's cool. But yeah, I definitely am outside of the culture of it. But hopefully more experiences will come as more marimba students that come out of marching band that want to play solistically, that want to become an artist, then. You know, I can maybe help with that as well. But in that case, it's not a solo instrument, right? Or marimba is not a solo instrument until you leave the field.
So at St. Olaf, there's no marching band component. So what's the ensemble, both the percussion ensemble and the large like concert band orchestra setup, or what do you get to play in while you're there?
They have a lot of opportunities. If you're a percussionist, then they will give you the opportunity to perform in the band, symphonic band, or the St. Olaf band. And then there's a second band, Norseman band. And then I think there's a third one called Valhalla, which is way less of a commitment. And then there's a St. Olaf orchestra. And then Philharmonia, which is the second one. So plenty of playing. The top groups play standard rep and also do commissions and they're a lot more innovative. And like they just continuously have been producing a lot more because there are composition majors there and they collaborate with outside composers as well. Yeah. And then percussion ensemble, they're always innovative with their programming too. And you can watch all of those videos, all those streams on their website. So if you wanted to see what their band sounds like, what their orchestra sounds like, what the percussion ensemble sounds like, all their concerts are up on stream. And, you know, if any listener is, curious about St. Olaf, I'm sure plenty of people will be happy to help you if you are, if you can't find any resources for them. But either way, the orchestra and band rehearsals don't overlap, so you can be in both. And that is huge for percussion. Then you can get experience in both. You can go on tours with both. But I'm talking about the top groups. But if you're looking for performance opportunities for big ensemble pieces, yeah, that's not an issue. And then there's jazz bands as well. And they're jazz band was I think they were number one college jazz band in the US by Downbeat magazine at one point. They have a really big they have a big reputation. But the St. Olaf choir is the most famous out of the music department, but they don't need percussion. So
oh,
it was everything but the choir. Like, do you want to St. Olaf? They just sing in the choir. No, ma'am, I did not. Or they would say that it's Betty White's college, because in The Golden Girls, she went to St. Olaf's or something.
Oh.
So there's another reference.
That's good. I like that.
Mm-hmm. But what St. Olaf provides, I think, is really special is that everybody works really hard, even if they're not music majors. And when you're in that group, you can't tell the difference because everybody is so good at their instrument and so passionate about it. So yeah, it's certainly a great experience for the liberal arts college student for sure. I went to St. Olaf as a pre-med bio and music double major. And then I changed my major 2 more times and then I became a performance major.
When did those changes happen? Were they quick or were they
late? It took 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a moment during my sophomore year when I just had to sit down with myself and ask, what do I really want? And then I couldn't figure it out. And then the dean at the time he came up like a wise, you know, sage just kind of floats into your peripheral. Mm-hmm. And then I was talking about it and he's just like, he just told me, well, it seems like you already made your decision. I did. You could just tell by the way I was talking about it that I really wanted to pursue performance. So, but before that, yeah, I was really into biology. I loved AP Bio when I was in high school and wanted to just nerd out and be in that field. Also, my grandpa, a long, long time ago, he had a bunch of sons that were musicians. So he said, it'd be nice to have a doctor in the family sometime. Oh, wow. And I was 5 years old when I heard that. Mm. And so that was always kind of, in the back of my head. Like, I'm going to be helpful to the world by becoming a doctor. And yes. So that's how I started out. Realized I hated it. And that conversation with the dean, I was saying, is it going to be helpful for people if my heart's not in the job? And for some situations, yes, it does matter. Like, it doesn't matter that you don't care about it, but you're doing it. And that's helping people. That I understand there's situations like that. But if I'm in college and I'm trying to choose one path, then for now, right? Mm-hmm. In college, they never tell you that you can change your life path after college. Right.
Yeah. You know?
It's just like a one and done and like, oh my gosh, my major is not like, what if I can't get a job in my major? And my whole life is screwed if I don't. And it's like, no, it's not true at all.
It's not.
It's really not. Talking to undergrads, at St. Olaf, and they're asking me, okay, so how much of this can I do without dying? Juggle like 5 other items, like this, I can't quit this because of like, whatever's happening in that field and this field and like sports and clubs, whatever. Dude, chill out. It's okay. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, this is true.
I mean, it matters. I'm not saying it won't matter. I can't say it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
But that's just like saying I don't care. And right. that's not true. But it's important to know that you're still you. And right. You might do something in a different order than you expect. And that doesn't mean that you're taking it for granted at all. And if you are saying yes to everything and you're a jack of all trades and master of none, which is a lot of Minnesotans, actually. Oh. Like, we just don't learn how to say no.
Mm-hmm.
So then you just say yes to everything and everybody's burnt out.
Right.
And you can't do anything like really well. I don't know about that, For me, I was able to focus, channel in more of myself as for more of my vocational decisions as a musician.
Yep.
And that way, and take drum set lessons, I was also taking percussion methods, of course. Yeah. So, that's pedagogical, information that's really important. And now, I still have a lot of different unique opportunities that I feel like are fulfilling. So it might not be you know, in a lab, but in a white coat and saving children's lives and stuff. But I am making a lot of people smile.
Yeah. And,
you know, I'm making, I'm being very helpful. So in the music sense, so that people can create their own art. So, or I'll make my own and then they can get inspired. I don't know. Yeah. Hopefully inspired or disgusted. I'm not sure, but hopefully inspired.
It can go either way.
Right.
Depending on the movement, honestly, it's not even the.
Yeah. And I took that from my piano teacher would say, you're very musical. Like it, of course I'm music. It's music. Right. But I didn't really understand that until later. Mm-hmm. Like being artistic and being musical is very different than being technical. There are no wrong notes. Right. So that's something that didn't occur to me. And then being in percussion, being musical in percussion is, I think, it takes a lot of training, I think.
Yeah.
Because how do you hit objects artistically in a way that, you know, makes sense musically, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's easy, Ari. All you do is you strike something and then you slowly move your hand away, and that's art. That's all
that. That's a whole note right there.
Exactly. Yes. You see the note was, you still heard it sound because my arm was moving away from it.
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh,
easy.
My gosh.
Yeah. Well, I like that is an awesome point about the musical versus the technical, because to me, what I think that the teacher was saying, and you correct me if I'm wrong, was it didn't matter what vehicle, what instrument, it felt like you had a sense, you had a musical sense that as long as you understood the instrument that you were going to play, that was going to come out.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that works for a lot of other percussion instruments. It's not just marimba, mm-hmm, or timpani even.
Yeah.
There's the solo CD I did, I played on some clay bowls. And it's just improvising on bowls. Actually, there was this random gig. I was on a boat and just like a little, you know, tut tut tut, little boat, rowboat. I don't know, but it has a motor engine. Anyway, okay. So we would drift on the river, and I would just play clay pots and improvise, and that was the gig.
Yeah, nice.
Just like floating in the water, mm-hmm, and playing, and then I would have water in some of the clay pots. And then they would, you know, they would change the pitch as I poured it, or, you know, changed.
Or yeah, rain, I guess, you know, whatever.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, you can make it work. It's not about faking it. It's about bringing the music to life. So
yeah,
I think a lot of percussion education misses out on that part in the beginning. Percussion education is so much more, okay, did you play that note or did you not? Did you play that crash cymbal on beat one or beat two?
Are you moving your wrist correctly to do this, you know, to play the double vertical?
Yeah. And I mean, that's all important because it's safety. Mm-hmm. You use proper technique, and that's good. And you have to know how to count so that you don't get yelled at,
right.
You know, and they don't have to think about cueing you every time because you can't count. Like, you have to be reliable, and that's fine. But the sense of creating your own sound, or creating something that's not on paper. And we have to make sure kids understand there's a point, there's a purpose to music that you will never play again. And that's the improvised stuff, the stuff that doesn't exist because, no one wrote it, and you write it at that moment and then it's gone. No one will ever play it again. And so those kind of pieces, those kind of moments are few and far between for anybody under the age of 18, I think. Yeah, for me, I was teaching middle school-ish, like 4 through 6th grade. And I would sometimes throw them into a moment of improvisation. And some of them hate it. Some of them are like, that's so cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's because when you're 11 years old, you don't really care about making stuff up. You think it's dumb. But yeah, I mean, the professionals make stuff up all the time. and like appreciating sound for what it is. And percussion students mainly don't really listen to their own sound. When they can't tell if a woodblock is cracked because they don't know any different. They've never played a non-cracked woodblock, right? So that's all. That's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
but yeah, kids don't listen to themselves. They have no idea what a snare drum is supposed to sound like because they don't hear it. Even if they heard a professional, I wonder if they would actually transfer it to their own ears of like, what are you doing? What are you making? What sound are you making right now? What did your drum sound like? And are you going to blame the instrument for it sounding not what you want? And I hope that, you know, in the future, students can have more ownership of being able to mess with their instrument a little bit more, not break it, but with proper teaching, you know, any student can tune a snare drum, you know, and figure out the note placement or mallet placement on a marimba. Like you're playing on the note, can you tell that all your accidentals are like muted, right?
Right. Anyway.
Yeah.
Or you go up to the note, you'd go up to the accidental and then you don't realize that you're the mallet that's still on the naturals is on a node, which is something I've been doing the last couple of days. It's driving me nuts. I need to pay attention and stop.
Oh no. Yeah. So learning to listen, I think, that was a transition for me too. You know, it's not rocket science. Right. but being able to appreciate the sound for what it is without thinking about, oh, I played this note wrong. Yeah. It's a little John Cage, you know. But sound is sound and it's not attached to anything. And you can, like, if you can appreciate it without without putting your own mind to it, your own context. Like, you know, if you play C, D, E, F, G, and people are like, oh, that's a C pentascale or a C major pentascale, right? Mm-hmm. It's just C, and then it's a D, and then it's an E. But like, who said that, you know, that relationship is more important than those notes themselves, right? So like, people like music because they're making a relationship between those notes where those sounds don't really care about each other. They're just sounding. So as long as you can make those sounds pretty, but yeah. Especially for non-pitch stuff, that's where it's more fun. Then there's so many colors that you can't explain. Pianists can't do either. Like you have your 88 keys and that's it.
Right.
Unless you're a new music person.
Right.
Then you can play on the strings and whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did play piano for George Crumb songbook in grad school. That was super fun.
Mm.
And then using using a piece of chalk, you would mark where you would dampen the string. And then when you hit it, then it's like a different frequency.
Right.
Yeah. So cool. Anyway, sorry.
Did you do like sonatas and interludes stuff from there or?
George Crumb songbook.
Crumb. I'm sorry. I had John. I'm sorry. I went John Cage. It's not as an interlude.
Oh yeah. Sorry. George Crumb.
Yeah.
Fantastic song. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there was one movement is Amazing Grace. It's literally just Amazing Grace, the song, but the accompaniment is just percussion. It's just like 12 percussionists, and it's just like it's not the piece. It's like how you feel during the piece.
Okay.
You know, that's it's like turned into music. So it's creepy and cool.
I gotcha.
And we'll get to part two next week, so stay tuned. This week's rave is the 2022 book, Overdue, Reckoning with the Public Library by Amanda Oliver. And I'll discuss more about why I'm discussing this book here at a later time. The author, Amanda Oliver, is a writer and former librarian who has written for and been interviewed for many publications over the years, particularly as they relate to her work in public libraries. This work is part history and part memoir, as it considers the history of public libraries, mostly taking place in the United States, as well as a telling of the author's time as a librarian for a public library, mostly discussing her experiences at a branch in Washington, D.C. called Northwest One. One of the premises for the book is to think about what the public library means to you. Maybe for many of us, myself included, if I'm being honest, it seems like a pretty cool place to work. You know, it's got books that need to be shelved, it's generally quiet, you can get a lot done there, it seems, etc. And honestly, that does tend to be true. What it also is, it turns out, and I have noticed this in our own fantastic public library, is that it is one of the only places in the local community that is hospitable to those who are in need of the most help. And this isn't about those who need book-specific or even computer-specific services. This is about those who deal with chronic mental problems, or are unhoused, or have a lot of trauma to deal with and have nowhere else to go. That place is also the public library. The historical section of the book talks about the history of public libraries and the ways that, while they are now open to all, have never been equally resourced among each other, but have frequently been set to keep folks out. And the folks that have been kept out over the years have been, shockingly, anyone who is not a white man. It also includes discussions of the structures of society that have led public libraries to be the final outposts for those who have not only been kept out of other libraries, but have been removed from society in total. The memoir portion, which is threaded through the brief history of public libraries and public institutions, is mostly focused on the time the author was a librarian in an underserved district in Washington, D.C. What is clear from this portion of the book is that the job of librarian at a place like she was working required abilities and skills beyond what one would expect from a job in a library. Her story in this role is sometimes harrowing and frequently dispiriting, and showcases the burnout that is felt by many in the profession. There's so much more to say about it, but this short nonfiction read is very much worth your time. Purchase or check it out, Overdue. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, leave a comment and a rating. You can find every episode and the show notes at the homepage at PeteZambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The show is also on SoundCloud and Spotify and many other podcast locations. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there on Instagram and X at Pete Zambito, or by email at PetesPerkPod@gmail.com. And I will catch you next time for part two with Ari Isamura. Until then.